Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia music director Ignaz Solzhenitsyn. He conducts Haydn's Military Symphony and Schubert's Great C Major Symphony in concerts tomorrow afternoon and on Monday evening. Works he describes as some of the most significant in symphonic repertoire. Susan Lewis considers the power of Mozart. Why are we so drawn to his music, and what's behind all the Mozart myths? Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo wonders why anyone would ever want to make their living as a composer. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Lantern Theatre Company as they prepare to open Novecento, a one-man show about the greatest jazz musician who never walked the earth. And in our regular look inside the culture file section at gophila.com, we visit the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Ignaz Solzhenitsyn had some pretty big shoes to fill when he took over from Mark Mostovoy at the helm of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia at the beginning of last season. He'd been with the group for the previous 10 years, so he was very familiar with and close to the musicians when he took over the director's post. Now he's well settled into the position and is enjoying putting his own personal artistic stamp on the orchestra. This is reflected not only at the podium, but also in the repertoire he's programming. We met earlier this week to talk about his own strong affinity for the pieces he'll conduct in the latest series of chamber orchestra concerts which begin tomorrow afternoon, Haydn's Military Symphony and Schubert's Great C Major Symphony.
The Military Symphony of Haydn, of course, is one of the 12 crowning symphonies that he wrote toward the end of his life when he was invited to come to England and to write these 12 pieces for performance in London. And so remarkable are these pieces, so path-breaking, so utterly free in concept and form, that it seemed to be a case of Haydn knowing that he had said everything he had to say in that form. And he never came back to the symphony, because still he had 15 years or so of creative life ahead, but he left it at that. And these 12 symphonies are an absolute apogee of symphonic writing to that point. The Schubert, one can easily make the case that it's the finest symphony ever. Obviously, one can get an argument in that, but it's one of the few works that should be mentioned in that conversation.
How so?
Well, it's a work unlike any that had come before, and really nothing has been written since that could match that kind of emotional intensity coupled with a absolutely clearly defined formal structure. We have Mahler, of course, and Shostakovich, where we have, you know, searing emotion, but then structure sometimes gets lost. And here, the structure is never lost. In fact, it's one of the most remarkable compositional efforts in terms of sonata form and in terms of how decisions that Schubert makes compositionally to deal with it. So it's a work that has unbelievable melodies. It's a work that has visionary harmonic, stunning harmonic events that are quite cataclysmic in nature, and a work that simply is demands everything from the orchestra and from the conductor and from the audience. There's nothing left after it. There's a reason it was nicknamed the Great, and if you think of all the symphonies, not just of Schubert, but of all the symphonies, you know, that's the one that has the nickname the Great, and it's really very very apt.
What makes these two symphonies so suitable for the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia?
Well, the Symphony No. 100, as really any Haydn symphony, is, of course, written for what we would now call a chamber orchestra. The C Major Symphony of Schubert may not be any more suited for a chamber orchestra than for a symphony orchestra, but it does seem to work very well in a chamber setting, and the greatness of the piece, its massive scope, still come across unconstrained and unhurt, so to speak, by the context.
Both of these regularly performed, very popular works. What do you think that you bring to them in these series of performances?
Well, that's a good question. I would answer it like this. Glenn Gould once said, one should not make the 96th or whatever recording of the Waldstein Sonata, referring to a famous Beethoven sonata, if one didn't have something new to say or something fresh to add. And I think that's an excellent point when it comes to famous works or to works that are played. Well, it's a good point for any music, but particularly for famous works. And certainly I feel very strongly about these pieces, that I have a clear interpretive point of view that I feel is useful to share with the public.
And so when you come up against a piece that both you,
the musicians, the audience is very familiar with. Do you have to go through, is it an intellectual process, or do you start to play it and see how it feels?
No, it's certainly the former. That is, in general, I think, a prerequisite for a conductor, for any musician, but especially a conductor who's responsible for how dozens of people are playing on stage, must evaluate and grapple with these complicated questions in advance and deal with the issues of tempo and the issues of articulation and the musicological issues involved and what to do about certain repeats and what to do about which kinds of instruments to use in the modern setting and all of these questions. The more clearly a conductor conceives of those matters in advance, the more effectively rehearsals go, and ultimately the more polished and profound a performance can be.
Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia Music Director Ignaz Solzhenitsyn speaking with me earlier this week. The orchestra performs Haydn's Military Symphony and Schubert's Great C Major Symphony at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and on Monday evening at 7:30.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
With all the Philadelphia hoopla about the 300th birthday of You Know Who, another birthday, almost as big, may have become a little overshadowed in the city of brotherly love. Just 10 days after Ben Franklin cut the cake at 50, another legend-to-be was trying out his lungs for the first time. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was born on January 27, 1756, which as of yesterday makes him 250 years of age. Although Mozart, in contrast to Franklin, pursued a career in only one discipline, his mark on the musical world is said to be as great or greater than any other composer in history. Today, that influence extends to psychology labs and healthcare centers. In this report, Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis explores the music and mystique of Mozart.
Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. I know that. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a Mozart. Da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a... Okay, you get the idea. Some of us got to know Mozart with gimmicks in music history classes. Others of us met him at our childhood piano lessons, maybe through one of his simple keyboard pieces, composed perhaps when he was, say, 5 years old. Today, some people will first experience Mozart's music in their cribs, or even in utero, as parents try to boost their baby's IQ. But no matter when and where he's first encountered, there's little argument that he is among the most, if not the most, popular classical composer today, and in this week of his 250th birthday, a little celebration is in order. As expected, his native Austria leads the festivities, with celebrations so numerous that USA Today suggested that Salzburg is on the verge of becoming Schmaltzburg. But as a city in the midst of our own Franklin frenzy, we shouldn't talk. Beyond the concert halls, Mozart's music is now being spun, so to speak, as a health benefit and something that can sharpen our minds. There are claims that his music can alleviate seizures, improve mental function in Alzheimer's patients, address childhood learning disorders, help you study, and even aid in the production of fine wine. So nurturing are his melodies to those grapes on the vine. The link to education and human health, at least, even has a name. The link to education and human health, at least, even has a name. The Mozart effect, popularized by best-selling author Don Campbell. So are we celebrating the man or the music? Or a little of both? What is it about this 18th century musical master that is so enduring and endearing? Well, first may be the fact that his music is sophisticated and at the same time so easy to listen to. He unabashedly reaches out to engage us, and maybe that was part of the plan. Mozart, like other composers of the time, was writing for people without CD players or iPods, who were probably hearing works for the first and maybe the only time. Yet of all the composers, says University of Pennsylvania professor and music department chair Jeffrey Kohlberg, Mozart writes the greatest simple music.
There's this question of relational richness. You can have a simple surface, but once you start looking at how the surface relates to the way the piece is put together, you find ever more complicated kinds of relationships going on. What's remarkable about Mozart is that simplicity is remarkably interesting and moving.
So you don't have to be a musicologist to appreciate him. Although, if you are a musicologist, like Kohlberg, or a professional musician like Ignaz Solzhenitsyn, pianist and music director of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, whom we heard from earlier in the show, you probably revere him as well. This spring, Solzhenitsyn will conduct and play piano with the Chamber Orchestra in a special three-part series on Mozart, whose simplicity, Solzhenitsyn agrees, is only a facade. What's behind it, he says, is about as complicated and as elusive as classical music can be.
And there may not be a more enigmatic and elusive figure than Mozart, not just in terms of his life and what drove him and what made him, but in terms of what he communicates through his art.
Of course, what drove and made Mozart the man he was also fascinates us. Mozart's life had all the elements of a colorful and sometimes comedic drama, the details of which are still the subject of controversy. Why did he die at 35? Was he poisoned by Salieri, as suggested by the movie Amadeus? Probably not, say scholars. Was he buried in a pauper's grave? Maybe a common grave, but the exact nature of it is still unclear. The various stories, say Kohlberg, reflect the inconsistent documentation of the time. Some things seem fairly certain. He was both a child prodigy and wildly prolific. Born into a musical family with perhaps the ultimate stage dad, Wolfgang spent his early childhood touring Europe, performing keyboard and violin in concert, and writing music. By the time he was 10 years old, he had composed over 30 works, including 4 symphonies, several arias, and a choral motet. By the end of his short life, he'd written over 600 works, excelling in nearly every type of composition, including concertos, symphonies, operas, religious, and chamber music. Although audiences of that day expected some improvisation, Mozart was a master at it, improvising cadenzas and, in some places, whole passages where his score indicated only high and low notes. Showing himself to be a modernist for his day, he even wrote for Benjamin Franklin's Glass Armonica. While his life and travels no doubt informed his work, he wasn't trying to compose his life, says Kohlberg.
We today would expect that a composer's life would figure into his or her music in some fashion, but in Mozart's day, there wasn't that expectation. And I think there's very little evidence that when Mozart was writing in a minor key, it was because he was having troubled times.
But he did have troubled times and struggled financially after he broke his ties with the court to go out on his own. And although his work was well respected, his behavior sometimes got him into trouble.
He didn't suffer fools gladly. He had very little respect for royalty. He was known to misbehave in public in various sorts of ways.
When Mozart died, his funeral was inauspicious, in stark contrast to the adulation the world offers him today. His impishness and his refusal to take the upper-class world around him as seriously as that world would have liked adds an intriguing twist to the image of a buttoned-up, bewigged classical composer. Maybe the secret of Mozart's greatness lies in the joining of these apparent contradictions, both in the music and the man. Simple but complex music from a jokester and a genius, an artist who not only pleased his audiences, but took his art form forward, laying the groundwork for future masters like Beethoven and Brahms and Schubert. With lyrical style and dramatic urgency, Mozart continues to intrigue and inspire us today.
And you can sing with him, if you'd like.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. Mozart could write a symphony while playing billiards, but Philadelphia Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo says composing's not so easy for mere mortals.
For the uninitiated, composing seems a very romantic pursuit, a creator pouring the guidance of a muse onto paper. But actually, it's the loneliest of professions, and one of the least satisfying. A painter or a writer can at least show work to friends, but the work of a composer doesn't even exist until it gets a performance. A successful composer lucky enough to receive commissions has to create to a deadline, whether the ideas flow or not. And a hopeful one may never discover if his work is even worthy enough to be played. Until recently, Felix Mendelssohn is the only composer in history who didn't have to write music to put food on his table. Even Stravinsky didn't receive international fees from his Firebird, Petrushka, or The Rite of Spring until he came to America 30 years later and made slight changes to begin the copyright anew. Composing is a curse in a way, and when I asked a composer friend why he went through such stress, his answer was, "It's my only aptitude." There's also the specter of some unusual historical ends. Jean-Baptiste Lully, who conducted by banging a cane on the floor, struck his own foot and eventually died of gangrene. Mstislav Karlovitz was buried in an avalanche on a ski trip. Krumpholz threw himself into the Seine and drowned when his wife ran off with his rival, Dussek. Charles-Marie Alcan was reaching for a copy of the Talmud when a shelf of Jewish religious books fell over and crushed him. Granados' ship in the English Channel was torpedoed by a German Navy boat, and Granados drowned after jumping from a life raft to save his wife. And Anton von Webern went outside to light up a cigarette and was shot by an American soldier one day after the German armistice. Between the ages of 33, the cruel lifetime of Schubert, and the 39 years of Chopin, you can count Bellini, Bizet, Gershwin, Weber, and birthday boy Mozart, who lived only to a mere 35. Then there's Beethoven, whose skull was found to be full of lead, the same affliction that is supposed to have made all the Roman emperors insane from drinking wine from lead goblets. Even when well-known in Vienna, the difficult Beethoven was constantly scrambling to make a living. So it's hard to know if he would have experienced rage or satisfaction from the recent discovery of an incomplete manuscript of his thorny Grosse Fuge, found last fall at the Palmer Theological Seminary on City Line Avenue. It was sold at auction last month. The winning bid? $1,950,000.
Philadelphia Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo. Now it's time for our regular delve into the Culture Files cabinet at gophila.com.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
The 1943 song written by Oscar Hammerstein for the hit Broadway musical Oklahoma. Inspiration for the song didn't come from the sparse prairie of the Great Plains, but from the land around Hammerstein's farmhouse in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The prolific songwriter was not the only artist inspired by the rustic beauty of Bucks County. The area was a draw for artists of all kinds, among them such luminaries as Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perlman, and Hammerstein's friend James Michener, whose book he adapted for the hit musical South Pacific. Bucks County, like many American exurbs, has changed. Many of the farms have been replaced with subdivisions, where woods once grew, parking lots and shopping malls now stand. There are still glimpses of what made this region attractive. To farmers, the fertile soil. To artists, refuge from the chaos of the city. And then, as it often goes, developers. In the county seat, Doylestown, there's still evidence, though, of what once was. Nestled between highways and strip malls stands a preserved American small town with a hint of a French village. There are shops and cafes and even a thriving cultural center. Down the hill from the quaint business district is a large castle-like structure housing the Mercer Museum, and across the road stands a sturdy yet somewhat ominous-looking building.
For some time, the county thought they would tear the place down because, you know, it was a prison. It was a terrible place. It was a medieval dungeon.
But thanks to forward-thinking trends in development, reuse conquered demolition, and the 19th-century prison was tastefully transformed into a 20th-century art museum. Bruce Katziff is director and CEO of what is now the James A. Michener Art Museum. He says its 1988 opening was not only following trends in building preservation and reuse, but also trends in museum culture.
In the 1980s, we were opening 1.2 new museums a week in America. And many of those museums, most of those museums, were focused on some kind of regional culture or some kind of regional experience.
And this new museum was no different. The renovated building is a seamless union of stone prison walls and new large glass windows exposing an outdoor sculpture garden. But why James, or Jim as he's known around here, Michener? The Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist grew up in Bucks County. And although literature is art, it's not the kind displayed in this museum, or at most museums for that matter, says director Katziff.
In 1988, a friend of Jim Michener's, Herman Silverman, visited Jim in Texas, twisted his arm, and Jim reluctantly agreed to let them use his name. I think that Jim's fear was that this community might build a new museum, but could they really sustain it? I think his other fear was, would it become a credible institution? He was worried that his name might be attached to something that perhaps he wouldn't be proud of.
And Michener's concern that his name would be attached to something that was not a success eventually led him to donate a large sum of money to the institution. As a tribute to this native son, a visitor walking into the museum is greeted with a room dedicated to Michener, with his desk, baseball, and Presidential Medal of Freedom on display. There's also a room set aside for the world-renowned furniture maker George Nakashima,
who spent most of his creative years in Bucks County designing modern Japanese-influenced wood furniture. Bruce Kastev points out that Nakashima's work is displayed in museums around the world, including the Met and MoMA. But this collection is unique because the room was designed by his architect daughter, Mira, and is displayed so close to Nakashima's adopted home. And this is the main purpose of the Michener Art Museum, to collect and display the works of artists who made Bucks County home, and in doing so, capture the essence of the place that inspired their work. One of the most prolific groups of artists to call the area home were the Pennsylvania Impressionists, a group of painters who were active in Bucks County in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A colony of Pennsylvania Impressionists formed in nearby New Hope along the Delaware River, and word of the colony attracted more artists to the region. The main gallery walls have works of such prominent Pennsylvania Impressionists as Edward Redfield and William Lathrop. The subjects of the paintings are nature and small-town landscapes. The irony of this collection of paintings is not lost on Bruce Kastev.
50 years from now, one of the only remnants of the beauty of Bucks County may well be our collection, because so much of what those artists were painting back in 1920 and 1930 no longer exists.
Not that the Michener is trying to become a museum dedicated solely to images of Bucks County past. They're building a collection of contemporary art as well. And James Michener would be glad to see that instead of failing, this building with his name on the front is in fact growing. In 2002, an annex to the museum was built in New Hope. Therein is an exhibit devoted to the lives of Bucks County artists. Curator Brian Peter lists some of the subjects.
People like Oscar Hammerstein, Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perelman, Pearl Buck. The visual artists we chose were Edward Hicks, Daniel Garber, Edward Redfield, Charles Sheeler, and writers like Gene Toomer, the great African-American writer. They're figures of real national importance who lived and worked in Bucks County.
But is this creative legacy going away along with the farmland that's being developed? Curator Peterson thinks not.
I would say, as opposed to 100 years ago when the Impressionist painters were here, it's not as cohesive a community of artists. It's much more varied stylistically, and there isn't this sense of a kind of a tight-knit community as there was then when it was much smaller and sort of in simpler times. But there's a lot of very interesting and significant artists that live and work here now, and as I say, in our exhibiting and collecting, we try to honor and focus on that as well as on the historic people.
More information on the James A. Michener Museum is available at the Culture Files section of gofilla.com. Imagine a man who was born, abandoned, and grew up on a ship at sea, allegedly became the world's greatest jazz pianist, and never once set foot on dry land. This is the premise of Novecento, a one-person show at the Lantern Theatre in Philadelphia, written by popular Italian novelist Alessandro Baricco and translated into English by Michael Golding. Novecento was critically acclaimed at the Edinburgh International Festival in 2001, and now the Lantern Theatre in Philadelphia has secured the rights to stage the play's US premiere. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer saw Novecento earlier this week and has this report.
Novecento's full name is Danny Boudman T.D. Lemon Novecento. The extraordinarily gifted musician was named and raised by crew members of the ocean liner The Virginian. The fictitious tale of the piano player is recounted from the perspective of trumpeter Tim Tooney, who for 6 years played with Novecento in the Virginian's onboard jazz band, which served to entertain the vessel's first-class passengers. While Tim Tooney is the only visible character in the Novecento narrative, he acts out all of the roles in his anecdotal reminiscing, making for a fascinating tour de force performance. In 2001, the Philadelphia Theater Initiative sent a group of theater artists from Philadelphia to the Edinburgh International Festival in Scotland. The annual celebration showcases world-class theater, classical music, opera, and dance. Among those who took part was the Lantern Theater's artistic director Charles McMahon and actor Frank X. McMahon recalls his initial reactions as he took in Alessandro Baricco's Novecento at the festival, a work presented by a Montreal-based theater company.
I was sitting next to Frank when we watched it, and we were just mesmerized by this piece. It's the power of the language to evoke images and emotions, and it worked at a number of different levels, and I was pretty much awestruck. And afterwards, walking out of the theater, I just turned to Frank and said, if we can ever get the rights to do this, you're doing it right. And he quickly assented.
The Lantern Theatre Company did get the rights, and as planned, the role of Tim Tooney in Novecento went to Frank X.
When I first went on board, I was 17 years old. So in Ira, they were looking for people for the Virginian. Down at the port, I lined right up. Me and my trumpet. January 1927. The man from the company sized me up immediately. Hey! Yeah, we got all the musicians we need. Oh, yeah, I said. And I started to play.
One never does see Frank X actually playing the trumpet in Novecento as Tim Tooney. Although the drama is largely centered around themes of music, playwright Alessandro Baracco relies almost exclusively on words to describe musical dynamics and tell Novecento's story. Frank X points out that the playwright's work doesn't follow the conventional narrative form employed by most plays, with a clearly distinguished beginning, middle, and end.
The script is sort of a mosaic in a way. It jumps in and out of situations. Characters pop in. Baracco is sort of a Renaissance man in Italy, evidently. He writes music, he writes poetry, essays, fiction, it seems, and plays. And you find all of that in this script.
The play's eclectic and unpredictable nature is also apparent to artistic director Charles McMahon. According to him, the structure of the play is reminiscent of jazz music.
One of the things about jazz, is one of the lines from the play is, what is it, if they don't know what it is, what's the line?
Oh. When they don't know what it is, it's jazz.
Yeah. The potential that jazz music has to be anything, to go anywhere, to deny itself nothing in terms of the full range of expression between the musician and their instrument. In something like this, it's going one place at 90 miles an hour until it decides to take a left turn, and then it's going that way 90 miles an hour.
The sea has awakened. The sea has gone mad. The waves explode against the sun, explode and howl.
As demonstrated by scenes like this, in which Frank X as Tim Tooney describes a raging storm at sea, the Novecento play relies heavily on the imagination. Director Dugald MacArthur calls the play a jazz fable, reflecting a literary form that conceals a moral within the story and, according to MacArthur, presents elusive characters.
Novecento does not appear that often in the play, and when he does not speak a lot. He remains a mystery, and that's one of the things that pulls you through the play.
Confident that audiences would indeed find Novecento compelling, the Lantern Theatre Company needed little convincing that they wanted to produce the work when Charles McMahon and Frank X first encountered it in 2001. But getting the authorization to actually stage the Baracco play was not as simple. With the success of the show in Edinburgh, the rights were optioned by a theatre company in London, which intended to do a large-scale West End production of it and later bring the piece to Broadway. The complex financing and resources necessary for the ambitious project, however, never worked out, and the play lay dormant for a number of years. Many of the other theaters that had been interested in producing the piece after seeing it in Scotland lost track of the show. But the determined Lantern Theater stayed in touch with the Italian agents who were handling the play's rights, and when the London company's control of the script expired, the Lantern acted quickly, securing permission to produce the American premiere of Novecento, which opens this Wednesday and runs through February 26th at the St. Stephen's Theater on 10th and Ludlow Streets in Philadelphia.
WRTI's theater reporter Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also to Karen Lyman, Rich Duran, Marla Del Sordo, Aaron Palmer, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.